Hello and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts here, Dana Azban, here with my friend Chavruta and Gordon. Our daf today, Masechta Bava Kamma, daf Kuf Tet Vav, page 115. Well, we're in our final stretch of Bava Kamma. Please join us for our Siyum, which will take place in a week. We have information on how to register on our Facebook page and our Talking Talmud WhatsApp group. If you'd like to get some information about it, you can always email us at talkingtalmud@gmail.com. And we can't wait to finish up this Masechet with everybody, but we still were, that only means we're 2 weeks through the Bavas. So we still have a lot more to do when it comes to Nezikin. I want to talk about this new topic that comes up here of a Takanat Hashuk. And one of the things that the Mishnah talked about is that if somebody recognizes his stolen object in possession of somebody else, right, who let's say had bought them from a thief, right? You bought something. You didn't realize it was stolen. Somebody else sees the object and says, hey, that's actually a stolen object. So the Gemara then talks about, okay, what happens when we discover who the thief is? You know, we discover that there's a thief here. So Itmar, it was said, Ganav machar v'chakach hukar haganav. So somebody stole some objects, sold them, and then afterwards the thief was discovered. Rav Mishame de Rav Chia Amar. So Rav says the name of Rav Chia, Hadin im harishon. The claim of the owner is only against the first one, meaning it's against the thief. Rabbi Yochanan mishamei de Rav Yanai amar, but Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rav Yanai, hadim im hasheni. The claim of the owner is against the second one, meaning the buyer. So the question becomes, who does the owner collect the money from? Rav says the owner needs to collect the money from the thief, whereas Rabbi Yochanan says, no, the owner can actually go to the buyer who bought the stolen object and can claim the money from them. So the Gemara says, actually, there isn't a machlokas between the two of them. Amar Rav Yosef, lo plige, right? They don't actually disagree. Kan lifne yeyush, hadin im hasheni, kan l'achar yeyush, hadin im harishon, right? So Rav Yosef says that the distinction here is not that Rav Yochanan and Rav have a machlokas, but it has to do with yeyush, right? Our favorite topic here of yeyush. When is there despair? So Rabbi Yochanan says that if the goods were sold before there was yeyush, right? In other words, the owner still thought maybe they could get it back. Then the owner goes to the buyer, right? And that you know, that's who he's going to go to. He's going to go to the buyer, you know, because basically he should get the stolen goods returned to him because he still thought that he was maybe going to get it back. Whereas Rav says that if it's after yeyush, right? Rav's opinion is if it's after yeyush, right? So it's after the owner thought that he would ever get it back. So this way, the buyer, even though he bought something stolen, the buyer acquires it because there was yeyush here. And when there's yeyush, a stolen object can actually change its reshut. It actually can change its domain. Then the claim only goes against the thief, and you can't actually bring a claim against the buyer. You can't demand that the buyer return the stolen property or even compensate for it because it fully belongs to the buyer because there was yeyush there. The charvayu isluhu de Rav Chista. And according to this explanation, both of them, Rabbi Yochanan and the Rav, agree with Rav Chista's ruling. So this is a ruling that appeared on Kuf Yud Aleph, that if somebody steals something and another person sort of eats, you know, consumes it before the owner has yeyush, the owner can collect it from either party, okay? So this isn't the main part of what I want to get to. I'm just sort of reading through till I get to the part. So basically, according to Rav Yosef, if the owner hasn't had yeyush yet, Rav would agree with Rabbi Yochanan that the owner has a claim against the buyer. So now Abai is going to challenge Rav Yosef. Remember, Rav Yosef is Abai's teacher. Amrle Abai. So Abai says to Rav Yosef, Velo plegate, don't they disagree, right? When the sale was made before there was yeush. Ha matanoku na kilifi yeush dami upligi. Right? The Kohanic gifts that were sold to a non-Kohen instead of being given to a Kohen. Let's say there were gifts that were supposed to be given to a Kohen. They're stolen, right, in a way from the Kohen. They were given to a non-Kohen. Are similar to stolen goods that are sold before an owner has yeush. And they actually disagree about this case. Ditznan, right? We learned in a Mishnah. So here they quote a Mishnah from Chulin. Amar lo mechor li meha shel parah. If somebody says to a butcher, sell me the innards of a cow, bayu behen matanot, and the Kohanic gifts were in it. In other words, the butcher gave all the innards, including the maw, which is a part of an animal that had to be given to the Kohen. I don't know exactly what part it is, but it was part that had to be given to the Kohen. So the butcher, when he shechted the animal, he sold part of the animal that actually belongs to the Kohen, right? Notnin la Kohen ve'eino minakelo min hadamin, right? The buyer gives the gifts to the Kohen, and the butcher doesn't deduct the value of the gift from the purchase price. La kachemenu b'mishkal, right? But if he bought the cow's innards from the butcher by weight, right? He didn't just buy it as one whole thing of like the cow's innards is worth $100 and included that part, and he needs to be responsible, the buyer, for giving it to the Kohen. But it's more that he bought it by weight. In other words, he's buying, let's say, 50 pounds worth of meat, right? Then the buyer gives the gift to the Kohen, but he can deduct the value from the purchase price because he's not getting that. He paid for a certain amount by meat, meaning an amount of weight of meat that he could actually use. But Amar Rav, and Rav, right? So that's a Tana'itic Mishnah. Rav, as an Amora, comes and he explains this last part that says the buyer can collect the compensation from the butcher, not from the Kohen. Lo shanu elisha shakal latzmo. They taught that the buyer, right, doesn't have a right to the compensation from the Kohen, where he weighed the innards himself. He did the weighing himself. Aba shakal lo hatabach. But if the butcher weighed it for him, hadin im hatabach, then the Kohen, right, then the claim of the Kohen is actually against the butcher, right? The Kohen can actually sue the butcher for the actual money itself. If he wants to collect the money, he can collect it. So Rav Yosef, so the point here is that what Abai is basically saying is that, you know, it seems to say that there isn't, even before Yeyush, Rav holds different than Rav Chisa, the owner doesn't have a claim with the buyer. So Rav Yosef answers, Amai Afdin im Hatabach. So say that Rav means that the claim of the Kohen is also against the butcher. Mahu Ditema Ein Matanot Kuna Nigazlot, right? So Rav had to teach us because you might have thought that Kohanic gifts cannot be stolen. So therefore, the Kohen doesn't have a claim against the butcher. Kamash Malan, so Rav teaches us otherwise. Okay, so now the Gemara from here wants to say how Abaye understands these opinions of Rav and Rabbi Yochanan. L'Abaye d'amar plige b'may plige. So according to Abaye, who says that they actually do disagree, right? Rav Yosef says they don't disagree, Rav and Rabbi Yochanan. But Abaye says they do disagree. What do they disagree about? Kids of Rav Chisa, they disagree about Rav Chisa's ruling. Now they have a third different way to explain. So we have Rav Yosef who explains between, you know, Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, Abaye's explanation. Now we're going to have a third explanation of Rav Zvid, okay? So Rav Zvid Amar, Kegon Shinita Shu HaBa'alim B'yad Lokeach. This is a case where the owner despaired after the stolen property was in the possession of the buyer. Below Nita Shu B'yad Ganav. But the owner didn't have the spare while it was still in possession of the thief, okay? In other words, the transfer of the property from the thief's possession to the buyer happened before the owner actually had yeyush, right? The yeyush didn't take place till it was already in the domain of the buyer, okay? Ubaha pligi, and this is what they disagree about. Mar sabar yeyush v'achar kach shinui reshu kani. One holds, and this would be the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, that if you have Yeyush and then the change of the domain, the buyer can acquire the stolen property. Shinui reshut v'achar kach Yeyush lo kani. Whereas if there was a change of domain and then afterwards Yeyush, he doesn't acquire it. And that's why, according to Rabbi Yochanan, right, if there was this, you know, Rabbi Yochanan is going to hold, right, that you can only go, that you go to the buyer because there was a change of reshut, and only afterwards Yeyush, so the buyer didn't actually acquire it. Umar sever lo shnat, but the other Rav holds there's no difference. Either way, the buyer acquired it, and he actually owns it, and that's why the owner actually has to go to the thief. Okay, I actually happen to like that explanation, and now we have a fourth one that could explain of Rav Papa what the difference is between Rav and Rav Yochanan. Rav Papa Amar begilma dechule ama lo plige. With respect to a stolen cloak itself, Rav and Rabbi Yochanan agree, right, that it must be returned to the owner, okay? So what Rav Papa is saying is that Rav and Rabbi Yochanan both speak of a situation that's prior to Yeyush, okay? They both agree with Rav Chisda, and in such a case prior to Yeyush, the owner has a claim against the buyer. So the buyer has to return the stolen object. Here they use an example of a cloak without getting any compensation, okay? He may rabbinically, you know, have a right to compensation from the owner, and this is the piece that we're going to explain. What they disagree about is to whether the rabbis applied the takanat hashuk in this case, okay, where the thief has been discovered. So what is the takanat hashuk? That is that the buyer has returned the stolen cloak to the owner, but the question is, the takanat hashuk is that there were certain cases, right, where a buyer bought something that wasn't really something that should have been sold. And the takanat hashuk is that the rabbis basically gave the buyer the right to compensation from the owner for the money he lost, right? Or like, that's what the takanat hashuk is. Like, the idea is that we know that sometimes when there are transactions in the marketplace, right, that what can happen, maybe you ended up, you know, it basically protects the buyer, right? Because maybe the buyer bought something that he thought belonged to the seller, but it didn't actually belong to the seller. So the buyer kind of has this protection rabbinically that says, if you bought something and it turns out it wasn't something that you should have bought, right, you can go and actually try to get your money back for that, right? And so the question is, in this case, is there a takanat hashuk, right? In this case, did the rabbi say, could he actually go to the buyer and say, you still need to compensate me for the fact I had to give you back the stolen object, but you got to compensate me because I paid for it. Rav mashmei de Rabbi Chiya Amar. So Rav says, in the name of Rabbi Chiya, hadin im harishon, right? The claim of the buyer is the only one against the thief, and it's not against the, right, and not against the owner. Dina de lokeach de lishkol zuze miganav. So that the law with respect to the buyer is that he can recover the money only from the thief. Below asubo takanat hashuk. And the reason that the rabbis didn't apply the takanat hashuk in this particular case where the thief was discovered, right, which would allow the buyer to get the money from the, owner. But Rabbi Yochanan mishum de Rabbi Yanai amar, but Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Yana, hadin im hashinim. Rabbi Yochanan says that the buyer can actually have a claim against the owner, when that's what it means, the second one. So there's a totally different read here of when we say the Shani and the Rishon and the Shani here, right? The Rishon is either the thief. The Shani is not the buyer, but it's actually the owner. And that what Rabbi Yochanan is saying is that the claim of the buyer is against the owner. Dina de lokeach de lishkol mi baal habayit. That with the law with respect to the buyer is that he can get the money even from the owner. He is allowed to go to the owner and say, I'm giving you back your stolen object, but you still have to compensate me for the fact that I bought the stolen object. Ba'asubo takanat hashuk. And in this case, when the thief is discovered, even in this case, according to Rabbi Yochanan, the rabbis actually applied this takanat hashuk, okay? So this is a very interesting, this concept of the takanat hashuk, because the idea of the takanat hashuk is that it gives a certain protection to the buyers. So then the Gemara goes on, the Sabar Rav lo asubo takanat hashuk. Does Rav hold that they didn't apply the takanat hashuk in this case? V'ha Rav Huna talmidei de Rav Ave. Rav Huna was a student of Rav. V'chanan bisha ganav gilma v'zavna. When Hanan the wicked stole a cloak and sold it, ata lakami de Rav Huna, the owner came to Rav Huna, you know, for a judgment, right? Amar le lahaku gavra zil sharei avitach. And Rav Huna said to the man, to the owner, go redeem your pledge, meaning the buyer, he said to the owner of the cloak, you have to compensate the buyer for the cloak. So it seems like a student of Rav Huna, held by this takanat hashuk. So this would seem to say that Rav held by it because the student did, right? Shani Hanan Bisha, it's different when the thief is Hanan the wicked, right? It's interesting, there was like this known thief. Kevan deleka de ishtalume mine, since there was no possibility for the buyer to collect from him because he was so wicked or he had no money, kulohu kardami, it was if he had been discovered. So this was a special case. The Gemara from here is going to continue to discuss this takanat hashuk. They're going to give some qualifiers to it, right? Like Rava says that im ganav mifursamu, if it's a known thief, then they don't have a takanat hashuk, because I guess the idea is that the buyer should have realized this person is an honest person, so he never should have should have bought it to him. So again, they go back to the case of Hanan you know, this Hanan, that he was wicked. So in other words, why was he buying from him to begin with? So it's interesting. And I, so just read this whole passage. I'm not going to continue to read it till the end. There's just a little bit more here. And then even afterwards, they're going to give some real life examples of some cases where things were stolen and was takanat ashuk actually applied or not applied. So again, I think this is a wonderful example of a takana that the rabbis make, discussion over where does it apply, not apply. And then to wrap up the discussion, we get real life cases, right? Real scenarios to say, hey, did we apply takanat ashuk or did we not apply takanat ashuk?
So I think what's very interesting here is that there is such a thing as takanat ashuk to begin with, right? Meaning the fact that there's a recognition that theft and return, let's say, is a different kind of thing. It's a different identity almost to the theft itself inside a marketplace, you know, where you have lots of purchasing and a lot of people in and out and shopkeepers and so on, as compared to a theft from a home or that kind of thing. It makes perfect sense. I just think it's interesting that it is established here in this way.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. It's a huge takana. I think it really protects the buyer. And I
think it does,
like,
yes.
That was very common. And I'm not, like, the motivation for it is interesting.
Right, exactly. I think it's probably essential to keeping things going in an open-air kind of marketplace, right? Like, there has to be some, I mean, otherwise you have to have a police force standing by at all times, you know? This is, I think, a much easier way to establish, as they call it, you know, integrity within the marketplace.
Yeah, I hear it. Right. I see that. And, like, in other words, it keeps the economy going.
Right. Exactly. Okay. I'm going to pick up the new Mishnah, which is on Amud Bet. No, I'm sorry. It's on the very bottom of Amud Aleph onto Amud Bet. It is also about the realia, right? Like what happened back in the day in their real circumstances. And we have drama from this Mishnah going on to the next daf certainly as well. It's going to keep us busy for a little while. So we have a case where we have one person has a barrel of wine and one person has a jug of honey. So the barrel of the honey cracks. The person who has a barrel of wine spills out his wine. Apparently the wine is worth less than the honey. And he then, you know, enables the person whose honey would otherwise spill out of his cracked barrel to use the wine barrel for the sake of the honey. The owner of the wine, right, he only can collect the compensation, let's say, that he, for the effort he put into salvaging the honey. I mean, he doesn't get the payback for the wine itself. Unless he stipulates it in advance, right? I will save your honey and you will pay me the value of the wine, which I'm sacrificing for the sake of your honey. In that case, then, you know, with that stipulation, it's considered binding. You know, here, okay, I'll dump out my wine. It's not a written contract or anything, but it doesn't matter under these exigent circumstances. I find the whole case here, it's only the first half of the Mishnah. I find the whole case here fascinating, first of all, because I might have thought that honey is worth less than wine to begin with. That obviously depends, I suppose, on your vintage and so on like that. But also beyond that, right? Like, first of all, that somebody thinks, oh, here, use my barrel, right? This is also interesting. I would think that the sizes of the barrels would be substantially different, and it would seem otherwise. And the very fact that there is, you know, the fact that this is a Mishnah means that this is a kind of thing that actually might have happened or did happen, and it happened maybe at least enough to make it a Mishnah, which I find to be, as I say, it's a slice of the real life kind of, you know, handling of product that was going on at the time. Okay, now the second case. Shataf nachal chamoro v'chamor chaviro. So if a river washed away a person's donkey and the donkey of another person. Shelo yafe mana v'shel chaviro matayim. So his donkey is worth 100 dinar and the other donkey is worth 200 dinar. I do not know why one donkey would be worth that much more than another donkey. I don't know how much of this is hypothetical, but let's accept for the sake of the discussion, right, that the value of the donkeys is directly, you know, this different, double the other. So the person whose donkey is less valuable leaves his donkey, Nebuch, to the river and goes to help save the donkey of the other one, which is more valuable. Again, he can only claim any kind of compensation for the actual physical effort or time or something like that that he's put into this, not for the loss of his donkey that he let, you know, let go for the sake of saving the other one. Unless he stipulated in advance to the guy, all right, I'll let my less worthy donkey, less worth, I mean, I'm talking about in money, right? He'll go. I'll let him go and I'll help you save yours. And then, of course, likewise, this stipulation is sufficient to make the second owner have to pay pay for the loss of the donkey. Presumably it would be worth it to him, right? He still has his 200 mana donkey, you know, 200 dinar donkey in his own possession. So, but again, like, did this happen? How often did something like this happen? And if these cases are simply examples as opposed to, you know, concrete things that were even more likely to happen, I'm curious, you know, how often does someone say, okay, I'm going to let this go for the sake of helping you save your more valuable thing? There's a lot of information presumed in this to know that both parties know that which is more valuable. So the Gemara picks up on all this, right? Va'amai, he wants to know why the person who pours out the wine, and the wine and honey case is really all we have left on this daf. I'm not going to, you know, take us to the end of the daf, but just to be aware that the issues of the donkey really show up already tomorrow. So the question is, why can he just acquire, you know, why is he only entitled to some measure of compensation for the effort he put in? Why can't he say, I have acquired your honey from the ownerless property? What does that mean? It's hefker. What's hefker? We have a breita. Mi lo tanya. Hare shaya ta'un kade yayin v'kade shemen v'ra'a shehen mishtabrot. Lo yomar ha'ez et truma maser apeirot sheyesh li b'toch beiti. So there's this breita that if you're laden down, you're carrying, or you have a wagon or whatever with jugs of wine and jugs of oil, and you see that they're breaking and things are leaking out, so then the person should not say, here, I'm making this be truma, right? This, I'm going to make this be maser, and it's going to count for the maser that are the stuff that's in the house. Why? Because all of this that's leaking out is not really eligible for that kind of to be consecrated in that way. V'mamar lo amar klum. So the question is, you know, if he does say it, though he's not supposed to say it, but what if he does? Lo amar klum, it doesn't count as establishing, let's call it the leakage, as truma maaser, right? Meaning the fact that you can't separate that produce, you can't separate produce that's about to be lost, right? Like, and call that the truma. That's your tithing. Besides the fact that it's like sneaky and underhanded, it also doesn't work. But the point here is that the moment you're dealing with jugs like that, that you see that the property is like sloughing off, isn't that what's happening with our honey jug that has cracked? And in which case can we say, well, it doesn't have an owner because it's been cracked. The honey is, you know, slipping out to the public domain, shall we say. And can't he say, I'm acquiring it and just take the honey? He shouldn't be obligated to anybody. Idama Rav Yirmiyah. So Rav Yirmiyah has a different case where he rules in this question, and it's gonna, or in a comparable question, which is gonna have an answer for us. So what happens? There's the basket from the olive press and it's wrapped around the barrel so that it shouldn't break. So too, in this case, in our Mishnah, we're talking about a situation where there's a basket from the olive press that's wrapped around the honey barrel, so that even if it broke, it's not going to break completely, and therefore you can't call that hefker. It's not spilling out into the public domain. It's spilling out into the olive press basket, which is not how you want to keep your honey, but it certainly certainly identifies it still as being owned by the person who owns it, as opposed to losing it to hefker, losing it to the public domain. V'im amar lo amar klum, and the Gemara goes back to the statement where This, you know, if somebody says, well, that's going to be my truma, that's going to be my maser, and it doesn't count for anything. V'hatanya misha ba baderach u'ma'ot biyado v'anas k'negdo lo yomar harei hirot sheyishli b'toch beitim yecholim al ma'ot halalo v'yimamar dvarav kayamin. We have a comparable case where somebody's traveling the road and has money in his possession, and he sees, you know, a thug coming towards him, and he says, oh, you know, and again, the recommendation is that he should not say, I've got these coins are Master Shani, right? These coins are consecrated. They're the consecrated coins, or the produce was desacralized, right? The holiness was taken out of the produce and put onto these coins, meaning so that the thief should not, you know, think that he could actually use these coins for any such thing. It kind of, you know, the idea is, of course, that the thief is going to be very concerned about the consecration on the coins and the fact that they cannot be used for anything and not steal them, which is an interesting given or assumption on the part of the owner of the coins. But the point is that this Breita says, if he does say such a thing, which he should not have said, the Varav Kami, his statement stands, meaning it works. Those coins become Master Shani coins, even though he shouldn't have said it to begin with. So the Gemara has to resolve this. We're talking about a case where he could save his money. So he could have transferred that kedusha, he could have transferred the sanctity of the coin, of the Master onto the coins. But if that's a case where he's able to save the money, then why would he not say that it was, that this was the case to begin with? I mean, why is it only in the face of the thug? So the Gemara says, no, it's where he's saving the money with great difficulty. It's not that it's a normal situation. He really shouldn't be transferring sanctity onto these coins. You know, that may in fact be lost at whatever, but it would still count in the event that he would do it. We still have to understand our case. So then isn't it the case that whenever you've got a potential loss, transferring sanctity in that way, so there's another comparable case, and I don't want to delve into it too much, of these 10 barrels of impure wine that was untithed, and one of them is broken and the contents are leaking out, or maybe it was exposed, whatever, right? It's forbidden, right? They're not allowed to be taking from it, because it's impure and it's untithed. So that should not be dedicated to be truma. You still could say, or rather if one says, you could separate this is now going to be truma for, on the other nine, there's a barrel that has cracked, and it says, and the person says, this is going to be truma on the other nine barrels to salvage it all. So isn't that okay? And the answer is, well, it's not really okay. But the Gemara here says, specifically, if it were oil, he should not do that because it would end up being the loss to the Kohanim. In any case, and this is the point, right? We come back to Rav Yirmiya. Amar Rav Yirmiya, kishekel beit habad karuch alea b'shlama shenishbara chazia, ela nidgalta lamai chazia. So again, this question of the basket from the olive press, if it's wrapped around the barrel, so it's going to protect the contents, at least to some degree, then that rationale is only going to apply when you've got a barrel that's broken, and that you can still use whatever was inside, you know, that it still works. But if you're talking about something that's been exposed to the air and been damaged, then how is Rav Yirmiya's solution any solution? And I'm going to actually stop here because it gets much more involved into all of the questions of what happens to the wine, right? That's now, if you were dealing with wine. Our original case in the Mishnah is not the wine, really, because that's what's being spilled out. We come back to the honey. But this whole daf is dealing with the case, you know, this sidebar about if it's truma, if you've established it to be truma, and when is that acceptable with wine, and what if there's sediment in the wine, and also, by the way, why the oil is even a more complicated case in terms of the loss to the Kohanim. We'll come back to the honey tomorrow, and we'll come back to the donkey from the Mishnah tomorrow as well.
That's our top discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to our venue, Michelle Farber, for hosting us on the Hondra website. Let us know what you thought about this stuff on our Talking Tomlin Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn.